From the Sky News Centre at 5, a computer programmer who tried to buy ricin over the internet has been jailed for 8 years. Muhammad Ali from Liverpool ordered enough of the chemical to kill hundreds of people, but was tricked by an FBI agent who sent him harmless powder instead. The 31-year-old was apparently inspired by the US TV program Breaking Bad, and Detective Chief Superintendent Tony Moll says his online browsing history was chilling.
What we have seen is some interesting internet searches ways, and he's researched cyanide, he's researched how to kill a pet. So it seems that he was looking to potentially experiment with the drug and see what it would actually do.
An 18-year-old who stabbed a teenager to death in an attempt to steal his bicycle in North London has been jailed for a minimum of 21 years. During sentencing, the judge told Joshua Williams the murder of Alan Cartwright was gratuitous and senseless. Four men have been arrested on suspicion of attempted kidnap by North Yorkshire Police. It's after a suspicious incident involving a 13-year-old girl in Ripon yesterday. The UK government's ordered what it calls a factual assessment of paramilitary organisations in Northern Ireland. The Stormont Assembly has been near collapse because of allegations the IRA is still operating. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Williams.
Hi, I'm DJ Spungold. Tune in to the Baby Boomtown Show every Friday at midnight to hear hidden gems of music across the genres, old and new. One love, one nation. Love BCFM. BCFM.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Conservative Deputy Mayor and Councillor for Westbury on Trim, Jeff Gollop. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, women in Iran. Would you go on holiday there not knowing about the rules about wearing the headscarf or hijab? Soraya Sepahfor Ulrich was born in Tehran but brought up in Godalming, Surrey. She now lives in California but looks forward to revisiting her homeland Iran, believing many Western women are missing out on a wonderful Persian culture because they don't understand the rules. Plus, we hear all about the scourge of so-called terrorism in the Middle East, the US and Europe, but what about Southeast Asia? There, the Muslim Rohingya minority in Burma are being repressed and other peoples too are victims of state and terrorist violence. So, we hear from Professor Bilveet Singh, he's head of political science at Singapore University, about a region with a large Muslim population that's now being talked about as a potential flashpoint between the US and China. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the hotspots of the world in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius, mainly dry this weekend, highs of 18, sunny on Saturday but cloudier on Sunday. Next week, highs of 18 Celsius again, sunshine and showers this week with some heavy and thundery downpours. Next weekend, 26th and 27th of September, highs of 16 Celsius, sunshine and heavy showers next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Conservative Deputy Mayor and Councillor for Westbury on Trim, Jeff Gollop. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the Politics Show. First of all, what's your take on the arena news this week, particularly that it doesn't look as if there's going to be any extra parking there or very, very little? For most of the people that are going to come into events, we know they want to use their cars, but it doesn't look like they're going to be able to.
Well, you know, I started off being very concerned about this, and I've had lengthy discussions with the mayor and with others. And I'm beginning to see there's an alternative way of looking at this, because there is a concern that if you actually make the car park the destination, people will inevitably use their cars. And the positive view is that at the times when events are happening at the arena, there are plenty of other parking spaces around in Bristol. What convinces me even more is that the people operating the arena, who are experts, we understand in what they do, are happy that the parking facilities are sufficient for them to be able to run it as a viable arena. So I think we've all got to come around to the viewpoint that we've got to look at other forms of transport rather than simply relying on the car.
What about the fact that most of the car parks are a fair walk away from the arena, so people would have to park their car, and then, you know, there's another journey to do, isn't there? The reason people use their cars is because they can use it to go where they want to go, and then walk.
But bear in mind, over the next 18 months, we are going to have a significant amount of roadworks in the centre of Bristol while the bus rapid transit is put in place. And we're also going to have the local train lines rejuvenated and made to provide a proper public transport system. So, in fact, the way people travel around Bristol is going to change massively by the time the arena is fully on board.
There's always this one question to me, which still hasn't really, I haven't seen it answered properly, and that is, there's a big debt hangover from this for us, the council taxpayers, for mm-hmm. you as city councillors. If there is any question about whether that can be paid back or not in the long term, why isn't a private contractor building this arena?
The whole question of how we move this forward is there's very much a situation of building the enterprise zone around Temple Meads. And the fact is that there's got to be some local government buy-in to make it happen. There's got to be something to provide the seed corn to start things working. Where the payback will come are from the other businesses setting up in the enterprise zone, creating jobs and creating wealth for the city. That's already starting to happen, but it needs the initial investment in the arena to actually bring about the investments in the rest of the businesses that are needed in that sector. So it is the city council taking a risk, but a controlled risk, to generate real opportunities and payback so that we can reinvest that money in future projects for the city.
Now, call me naive, but I thought that the private sector was out there to go and take risks, not the public sector.
I think both have to take risks. The public sector takes risks on a regular basis, but is much more risk averse, and that therefore sets up enormous procedures to avoid that risk. What Bristol recognises is that we have got to create opportunities. The pressures we've got on providing services are not going to go away. We have to create more jobs and more opportunities so that we can bring more funding into the city.
What about something like, say, a house building programme? That would be creating jobs, wouldn't it?
It would. The council is extremely keen on a house building programme. If I understood it, I still couldn't explain it to you in the remaining hour of this programme. It is a frighteningly complex process, and unfortunately the controls in place prevent the city council from spending its money on building houses as much as we need to. But the council is in discussions and is continually looking at opportunities to raise funding to enable that house building to take place. So, yeah, you're right, and it's on the agenda, but it's not happening yet.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, on the arena, I mean, we'll go on to the sort of the Corbynistas and the change that there's been in the Labour Party a bit later, but on this specific thing, which is very local to us, does it bother you too that we're in a situation where there's a big project that looks more like a private sector thing than a city council thing, mainly because it, you know, they're likely to be having commercial acts, all this sort of thing on there. And why would something, if the private sector are not prepared to finance, why would the public sector go and say, actually, we will take a risk to build this place?
Well, I mean, there is a case for public sector entrepreneurialism, particularly when you've got a very long payback period on a particular project. The private sector won't pick up projects which don't pay back in a relatively short timescale. So, you know, things like the Channel Tunnel, for example, was failing at one stage because it was a public sector project, and then the private sector were brought in, and then the private sector couldn't see the payback from it. On the actual arena itself, I'm agnostic. I simply do not know the detail about whether this is a viable project or not. But what does worry me is I'm actually fairly pessimistic about the future of the economy of Britain and the world, and Bristol as part of that. And you could end up with a situation where the City Council basically has a lemon on its hands, which isn't actually paying back the investments that have been made. It's all of the projections, I presume, are based on the idea that the economy will continue to grow steadily, etc. And I question whether that's actually the case.
Jeff?
Well, yes, but it's based on the fact that the enterprise zone will continue to grow. And whilst obviously a growing economy is a key part of that, all the indicators are that the enterprise zone will continue to grow anyway, particularly as we see the electrification of the line to London, which is going to make it a very welcome home for businesses wanting to come into the area. So for that reason, we believe we can be extremely positive about the outcome.
Well, I've got a bit of music now, and that is because we will talk about a certain part of our city, which is the police.
That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the bees. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the bees. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police.
Well, quite often you can hear the sirens going in the background as we're sitting here chatting at the City Academy in Lawrence Hill. But the policing of the area, Jeff, is most important, that the rule of law is taking place in Avon and Somerset Police. The Chief Constable is a key person in making sure that happens. And we've got a bit of a debacle going on, haven't we? We have had for the last, it's not 18 months, about 14 months or so of having a Chief Constable who's been suspended, and a whole wrangling over whether he's going to get his job back. The Chief Constable's name is Nick Gargan, but he's been suspended for a great length of time. And although a judge has ruled that he should have his job back, the Police and Crime Commissioner has told him he's got to resign. Now, there's some weird stuff going on here, because you can't tell someone to resign. They can resign if they want to resign, but you certainly can't tell them to. You can sack them, but there seems to be a halfway house going on here, and we seem to be stuck in a bit of a logjam. What are your thoughts on what's happened? Because I know two local Conservative MPs have said that they believe there's a witch hunt going on.
I think there's a real problem in identifying and understanding all the information. I have to say, as an outsider looking in, I'm staggered that it's taken as long as it has to get to a stage where we don't know the situation. And I am, to say the least, baffled that when rigorous internal procedures are followed, that there is then the ability to vary what happens in those procedures. I have to say, I think it has to be brought to a head very quickly and resolved, because there is the issue of what happened, but there's also the fact that whatever anyone has done, they actually don't deserve to be put through this level of suspense and uncertainty about their career and their future. So I think we've got the individual, we've got the morale in the police force, which must be its senior levels must be very unsettled by what's going on, and I would simply be urging it to be resolved very quickly, so that the senior police officer can get on with running Avon and Somerset Constabulary.
So we've got two initially alleged offences reported, or at least alleged offences of inappropriate behaviour of a sexual nature towards women officers. Those have been now said to be unproven, and anyway, they were made by, not by the people that Nick Gargan was supposed to have done something to, but by somebody else. So they were second-hand accusations, and now what we've got is a list of emails, basically, that have been, we've said this email was forwarded to this person who it shouldn't have been forwarded to, and we're not even allowed to know who the person is it's been forwarded to. So although we've got a list of inappropriately forwarded emails, now judge has had a look at this, he said there's nothing which is a sackable offence in here. Now I put it to you that this looks rather like the sort of phishing operation that the police are famous for, where there's an accusation of some sort, the police come in, they gather lots and lots of evidence, go through someone's possessions, personal belongings, etc. They'll find a few things that may be wrong with that person, and then they'll accuse them of that. That's what this looks like. It's almost like one of the worst sorts of practices that the police have been caught doing over the years being applied to the Chief Constable himself?
Well, I find it very hard to comment because I don't know the full detail. I certainly understand the complexities of employment law, and know that it's very dangerous to pass comment. And I simply don't know enough, but on the face of what you're quoting there, there does not seem to be the level of evidence one would expect. But I wouldn't want to comment any further.
There is a certain amount in the public domain, and this is a document which you can download from Sue Mount Stevens, the Police and Crime Commissioner's website. It's called Nick Gargan, Misconduct Proceedings, Proven Charges and Findings from the Misconduct Panel Hearing, which concluded on the 9th of July 2015. And this came out on the 11th of August. So it's a whole list of all of the things that Nick Gargan has done, supposedly at least been found to have done. Many of them he's been accused of gross misconduct, in fact I think on all of them, and found actually it's misconduct, which is the sort of much lesser charge has been found. But also one of the things that worries me about how independent Sue Mount Stevens is, because certainly it appears that she's married to this chap called Stephen Robertson, who's the chairman of Business West. I'm reminded a little bit, Jeff, of the whole situation with George Ferguson, when he runs as an independent, but actually he's a member of the Merchant Venturers, he's a member of the business elite of the local area, and whilst he may be politically independent, he's not independent from lobbying, because of course businesses do a great deal of lobbying, don't they?
Businesses lobby, communities lobby. I think you are looking to create a bigger issue than one that I see in this situation. I think it's much more about how we deal with the management of the police force and how long it takes a public body to resolve an employment issue. And those are much more the concerns that I would have.
Just looking at, you know, whether just how independent Sue Mount Stevens is, you've got her husband is the chairman of Business West, Martin. He's on the board of the University of the West of England, non-executive director of Hargreaves Lansdown. Over the years, he's done many sort of powerful jobs, which include director general of the British Retail Consortium, the member of the board and vice president's committee of Euro Commerce, advisory board of Retail Week. He's worked as the marketing director of Woolworths, marketing director of WH Smiths, many of these big corporations, and he's now basically the top business person in the whole of the southwest of England. As part of his job is basically taking quite a lot of public money and making sure that that's spent within the business community to create jobs. So he's actually quite a powerful lobbyist in his own right. And when I first met Sue Mount Stevens, interviewed on her in here, I'm thinking, well, an independent person has got no other influence. But if her husband is such a bigwig in the financial business community, how independent is she?
Well, I think when the election was held, that's definitely what her brand was, that she was independent, she wasn't party political. And I tend to take that at face value, as I do with George Ferguson. I think the real problem for me is electing police commissioners, because I don't think, in actual fact, she has the mandate to lose two chief constables like this. And this looks like shambolic, basically. And it was an accident waiting to happen. I think it was one of the last government's least sensible measures, and there was a pretty big competition for that, to elect police commissioners. And if we look at what's been happening in Northern Ireland over the last few weeks with the collapse of the power sharing executive and so on, they never introduced elections for police commissioners in Northern Ireland, because it would have been totally explosive and silly, because one community would never have been happy to have the other community elect the police commissioner, and therefore they didn't even think about doing it. The problem we've got here is that Sue Mount Stevens, frankly, is out of her depth, despite the fact that her husband's such a wheeler-dealer business-wise. She's actually stumbling around, stubbing her toe on various things. And I'm sure she's a perfectly nice person, and she has seemed very nice when she came on here. I just don't believe in having one person in total charge like that of an organisation like the police. I think the previous setup, where various sections of the community were represented on police committees to get a broad view of what the community wanted, was far better than a gimcrack election in which, say, 14% of the electorate participates.
Yeah, I mean, there's even quite a lot of stuff in the press. If you look on the internet, you see pictures of her and her husband together, but there's no reference to the fact that the two are married, you know. So anyway, moving on, we've got a bit of an even bigger story this week, and that is a new leader of the Labour Party. And here is an excerpt now from last Saturday's victory speech by Jeremy Corbyn.
Let's deal with the refugee crisis with humanity, with support, with help, with compassion, to try to help people who are trying to get to a place of safety, trying to help people who are stuck in refugee camps, but recognise going to war creates a legacy of bitterness and problems. Let us be a force for change in the world, a force for humanity in the world, a force for peace in the world, and a force that recognises we cannot go on like this, with grotesque levels of global inequality, grotesque threats to our environment all around the world, without the rich and powerful governments stepping up to the plate to make sure our world becomes safer and better, and those people don't end up in poverty, in refugee camps, wasting their lives away when they could be contributing so much to the good of all of us on this planet. We are one world. Let that message go out today from this conference centre here in London. I conclude by this. The Tories have used the economic crisis of 2008 to impose a terrible burden on the poorest people in this country. Those that have seen their wages frozen or cut, those that can't afford to even sustain themselves properly, those that rely on food banks to get by. It's not right, it's not necessary, and it's got to change. We need an economic strategy that improves people's lives, that expands our economy, that reaches out to care for everybody. You can't do that if at the same time you do nothing about grotesque levels of inequality within our society. We need to develop an economic policy that deals with those issues. And I say thank you in advance to us all working together to achieve great victories, not just electorally for Labour, but emotionally for the whole of our society, to show we don't have to be unequal. It doesn't have to be unfair. Poverty isn't inevitable. Things can, and they will, change. Thank you very much.
Refugee issue to begin with. Perhaps we can put that on one side for a minute and concentrate on the second bit of his speech, which was about changing economic policy. I think that's one of the reasons why he's won, is because there's a wide scepticism out there that the track we're on is the correct track. And if we look, in fact, at the fact that they didn't raise interest rates in the United States this week, and I don't think the Bank of England's going to raise interest rates either, that's because the economy ain't fixed. And the unemployment rate is starting to rise again. Now, what tends to happen when the unemployment rate starts rising is it carries on rising.
Well, hang on, because surely the unemployment rate always rises after a general election, doesn't it?
Well, that's because general elections are often related to spending splurges and
well,
so on.
No, I'm talking about because they fix the figures. You know, the figures...
Well,
unemployment looks good.
Well, but there are all kinds of questions about who is measured in on the unemployment figures and the inflation figures, actually. But I think what Corbyn represents is a decisive rejection of the neoliberal policies of the last 30 years. Whether it's going to be successful electorally is another question entirely. But I think for people like myself, the idea that he is an economic ignoramus, when you've got several, you know, people I really respect in academic economics all lining up to say, well, you know, we've got Paul Krugman from the US and Steve Keen, serious people in economic terms, Joe Stiglitz used to head up the World Bank. They're all saying, well, actually, what he's saying is common sense. And I think that's what he's tapped into in the Labour Party electorate.
I think one of the big worries about the new Corbynism is this absolute, I mean, I don't know how many times he said it there, equality, equality, equality. Well, yes, there are problems with gulfs between rich and poor when they get too wide, but surely for those who've worked hard and have become successful, this is a red rag to them. They're saying, well, look, because we've got problems with poverty, we're going to have to bring you down to a lesser level of wealth. We're going to have to take more off you.
People are failing to understand that the government intervened to prop up the private financial markets in 2008. They did it in the United States of America, the home of supposed home of free market capitalism. Now, what's happened is that asset prices have risen as a result of quantitative easing and low interest rates. That means that those who have assets to be at the beginning of the game have had the Duke of Westminster, for example, the biggest landowner in Britain, is now considerably more wealthy than he was at the beginning of the crisis. As are the top, you know, the top 1,000 taxpayers in Britain are considerably better off than they were, and that is because the government has intervened to protect their interests.
But Martin,
that is not free market. That's not a free market allocation of resources.
Jeremy Corbyn has said it himself. He said the bailouts in 2008 have been a terrible burden on the poor. Now, who was in power in 2008?
Well,
it was Gordon Brown, wasn't it? Your party.
Well, it was, and that's why Corbyn has thrashed the right wing of the party in an internal election, because there's an enormous amount of bitterness about the economic policy that was pursued and about the international policy. And I think that the grassroots of the Labour Party, which are, have been very disillusioned over the last 20, 30 years, have reasserted themselves. Whether this is going to win them national elections is another question, but that's what's happened internally.
You say Corbyn has frozen them out. Actually, most of them have said that they just refuse to serve with him.
Well, there's possibility of a split in the Labour Party. It happened in New Zealand in the early 1980s, and I think it's quite possible it will happen here. There is a real difference between people like Mandelson and Blair. I mean, Corbyn has said Blair ought to go to The Hague and be tried as a war criminal, and he's in the same party. That's a pretty big gulf, isn't it?
Well, it's certainly a recipe for quite a lot of infighting, which I'm sure Jeff is smiling, in fact, over.
That's right, get the
Jeff,
popcorn
anyway,
out.
What are your thoughts about the new leader of the Labour Party? We can't call it New Labour, as quite a few people are, obviously, because it's absolutely the diametric opposite. But the Corbynistas, if you want to call them, what do you make of them?
Well, there are a number of things. Obviously, I actually welcome it, but not necessarily for the reasons you might expect. I welcome it because I think it opens up the debate. It does put a difference between the two main parties, which I think is important, because I have to say, even as a Conservative supporter, it was sometimes difficult to see where the boundary was between the Conservative and the Labour Party. My brand of conservatism shares some of the views that Jeremy Corbyn expresses. Inequality is unacceptable in our society at the level at which it currently exists. And if he is going to raise that debate, as long as he does it constructively, I would be very happy in engaging in that process. I am going to disagree in terms of the economic situation, because I do not believe that you can come out of the economic crisis that was created in 2008 by simply spending money that you haven't got. So I see that we have to be careful how we spend our resources. And whilst Martin says it's common sense, I have to say I have not at this stage heard how Mr. Corbyn is going to fund his economic policy other than by printing money. And if one actually looks back at the fall from grace of past Labour governments, they have generally come about by printing money, creating an economic crisis, which has resulted in the country realising that it has to look somewhere different for the economy to be managed. So I do have very serious concerns about that aspect of economic policy, but in terms of actually championing those who are most disadvantaged, I believe that debate needs to happen, and it needs to keep happening, because we need to ensure that we are not pursuing policies that are severely damaging those who are most disadvantaged.
But Jeff, there's no point in having that debate if you haven't got a recipe to come up with the cash to fund it, is there?
And that's the challenge, that he has got to identify a viable economic solution.
This whole business of people's QE, Martin, is a different kind of printing money. It's not printing money to go into the stock market and into asset prices to keep people's assets up. It's spending it on public services and that sort of thing. But at the end, I mean, in a way, from what Jeff was saying there, I wonder if whatever happens, if the city don't like it, they can make mess for Mr. Corbyn, can't they?
They can, and I think Simon Wren-Lewis, who's an Oxford University economist, has not signed the letter in support of Corbyn. He says, I'm generally in support of what he's doing, but I don't believe in people's QE, because it's essentially, if there is another crash, something like that will have to be considered.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point, and that's what Corbyn is opening that debate up. Mm-hmm. I'm of the opinion that there probably will be another crash, and we will have to consider stuff like that. But of course, it's very difficult to talk about what you're going to do when that happens, when it hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. It makes it quite tricky to have the debate. And I think there's a wide consensus, and I welcome this wide consensus, that too much inequality is what makes our economy unstable. Mm-hmm. There's too many people at the top with their fingers in the till, frankly, and pulling, and you know, there is criminality at the top, and there's also just indulgence of as I said in what I first said, the government intervention to protect the assets of the asset holding classes has been very successful. That's what makes the stock market bubbles that we're seeing in the US and Britain continue. And that, in fact, is I see no case in that situation for turning around to the poorest in the society saying you've got to bear 100% of the burden of sorting out the fiscal problems of the country. That is clearly simply unfair.
I wouldn't disagree with that, but I'd have to say as well that I have never understood fully how quantitative easing works, because it seems to me very much like a question of the emperor and no clothes, and therefore there's no if in reality that doesn't really work, and all it does is falsely underpin asset values. Ultimately, that in itself is going to bring about a crash.
Well, indeed.
And it will do when it's stopped.
I mean, to try and sum it up, Jeff, the way I'd put it is this, and I may be wrong, Martin might correct me, is it's just simply turning on the money printing machines, but making sure that money goes into the casino economy rather than the real economy.
Well, but what's even more bizarre, as I understand it, Martin, is governments have been buying back their own debt that they've issued, which is a concept that...
Well, I mean, I think Mark, I can't remember the name, there's a Bank of England economist who said, well, actually, the money creation theory is wrong. That it was based on this loanable funds theory, and it's, you know, that there is money that people put in the bank and it's then lent out in multiples. But in actual fact, banks make money up. That's what they do. Yeah. And I think the crisis has demonstrated that.
And it's a kind of counterfeiting, isn't it? Which, if you or I was to sit in the hall out here with some plates making up £10 notes, we'd probably be arrested.
Interestingly enough, the real free market economists of the von Mises Institute, the Hayekians and so on, they don't believe in quantitative easing. Mm. They say exactly what I say.
And the Germans don't, do they?
No, they don't, but they're being forced to adopt it, because what happens is once you've started doing this, it's like becoming a heroin addict. Do you really want to go cold turkey? No, you don't. You want to get some more heroin.
But the Germans have the advantage of the Greek economy and other economies keeping the exchange rate at a level.
That's
which
right.
means they can trade.
Yes,
so.
Yeah, in other words, the euro has been very good for Germany, but very bad for Greece.
Yeah, the Germans have gained more than they've lost through.
I think the Germans in general, I think. I mean, their attitude towards the Yugoslavian war, when I used to work out there, was very parochial. They only think in local terms, whereas in actual fact, being British and the Americans, we think in global terms. Yeah. But at the same time, we shouldn't be money printing. You know, what was it? From 2008 to 2015, that's 7 years of zero interest rates and money printing. That ain't right. Can't be right.
I agree.
Okay, and now on to Prime Minister's questions, which was quite different this week. And Jeremy Corbyn explains the new Leader of the Opposition just how it's going to be different, and we may see more of this in future weeks.
I've taken part in many events around the country and had conversations with many people about what they thought about this place, our Parliament, our democracy, and our conduct within this place. And many told me that they thought Prime Minister's question time was too theatrical, that Parliament was out of touch and too theatrical, and they wanted things done differently, but above all, they wanted their voice heard in Parliament. So I thought my first Prime Minister's question time, I'd do it in a slightly different way, and I'm sure the Prime Minister is going to absolutely welcome this, as he welcomed this idea in 2005, but something seems to have happened to his memory during that period. And so I sent out an email to thousands of people and asked them what questions they would like to put to the Prime Minister, and I received 40,000 replies. Now, there isn't time to ask 40,000 questions today, and our rules limit us to six. And so I would like to start with the first one, which is about housing. 2,500 people emailed me about the housing crisis in this country. And I asked one from a woman called Marie, who says, What does the government intend to do about the chronic lack of affordable housing and the extortionate rents charged by some private sector landlords in this country? Prime Minister.
Prime Minister.
Well, first of all, Mr. Speaker, can I congratulate the honourable gentleman on his resounding victory in the Labour leadership election? Can I welcome him to the front bench and to these exchanges? I know we will have many strong disagreements, I'm sure, between us at these exchanges, but where we can work together in the national interest, we should do so, and I wish him well in his job. If we are able to change Prime Minister's questions and to make it a more genuine exercise in asking questions and answering questions, no one would be more delighted than me. I felt last week where we discussed a substantial issue with substantial questions and proper answers was good for our House, good for our democracy, and so I welcome it. Now let me answer very directly Marie's question, because we do need to see more affordable housing in our country. We delivered 260,000 affordable housing units in the last Parliament. We built more council houses in our country than in the 13 previous years had been managed, but I recognise much more needs to be done. That means carrying on with our reform of the planning system. It means encouraging the building industry to come up with innovative schemes like starter homes. But above all, it means continuing to support the aspirations of people to be able to afford their own home, which is where Help to Buy and schemes like that come in. But I'd say to the honourable gentleman, we won't get Britain building unless we keep our economy going.
Yeah. Well, first of all, in terms of question time, I mean, it's refreshing. And I have to say, whilst the point scoring of PMQs with Mr. Miliband and Mr. Cameron was occasionally entertaining, I'm not sure that it added a great deal to the human knowledge of the issue in question. And I have to say, I'd welcome the same thing in Bristol City Council of actual proper engagement. And the issue of housing as raised there is something that's so fundamental that actually we all need to be working together on working out how we can resolve that. So I hope that Prime Minister's Question Time carries on in that vein in a much more constructive way. As far as housing is concerned, we have the challenge in Bristol that we have a significant number of people who need those houses, and we don't necessarily have the space in which to build them. So actually, we've got to work with our neighbouring authorities in finding a solution to providing sufficient housing. My economic philosophy says that we need economic growth in order to sustain our city, but actually, we also need the houses to accommodate the people who are going to generate that economic growth. And if we don't provide sufficient affordable housing, our growth is going to stutter and stagger along and not achieve what's needed.
Martin, what's your thoughts then about the approach of inviting questions to the Prime Minister from members of the public, and also about the question that he chose there to start with on housing?
Well, I think it's probably, and he obviously picked it because that was what most people had said. I sent him a thing about foreign policy, but he obviously didn't decide to pick my question. I think what's interesting is that 30,000 people joined the Labour Party after the election. That's what he said. That's what's happened. So in other words, Corbyn's strategy is to reach out to people who have been alienated in the past. And I think because he has such radical views, if you like, he's got to get his personal presentation right if he's going to get those views over. And I think that's why people have voted for him, because they feel that he is somebody who isn't going to go for Yarboo sucks approaches. Mm-hmm. And I think we didn't really get to the meat there. I think we've still got a housing bubble in this country. Mm-hmm. And we've got a situation, for example, where the government is going to allow tenants to buy social houses which they're tenants of, which of course is actually telling independent organisations what to do. And there's also the whole thing of what is an affordable house. I mean, an affordable house used to be a house which was, you know, a council house, basically. Mm. And I think when you were talking earlier, Jeff, one of the reasons why Bristol City Council can't do what the council wants to do across the board is because they're tied down by Westminster bureaucracy, which refuses to let them, because they don't really want it to happen.
Yeah.
They say they do, but in actual fact, they don't. But if Conservatives like you, I mean, and the Prime Minister there was saying he was in, council housing, good. We've built more council houses. Well, if we can get a consensus on that, then we're really going somewhere, aren't we?
Are there any things you'd like to see, Jeff, change that would allow the City Council here to actually start doing some more house building? Because everyone seems to say we need it.
Well, the things I would like to see changed is first of all, we have 28,000 houses and we have a very modest amount of borrowing on those houses, and I would like to see the ability to borrow more against those houses opened up so that we can invest in more property. And I would like to see a relaxation on what we have to do as a local authority with our pension fund money, because I would like to see us investing that money in housing stock rather than in the stock market. And I believe that would be capable of providing a better return for our pensioners over the years, certainly a rather less volatile return for our pension fund members than happens at the moment.
Well, that's interesting. You mentioned the pension fund, because the temptation must be to go for high-value stocks that are going up, which include things like arms companies.
It's not as simple as that, because what goes up inevitably comes down anyway. So, and we do endeavour to have an ethical investment policy, although that's not always as easy to implement as one might like it to be. But the other thing I would like to see is working together more with the voluntary sector and the third sector to find new ways of funding social housing as an alternative to the models that have existed up until now. So, I mean, those are the three things I would like to see happening. I think it will take time for central government to recognise the importance of releasing the pension fund money and even of ensuring that we can borrow more money. But Martin's absolutely right. They're controlling what we can do, making it harder and harder. They've now said that rents have got to reduce by 1% a year, so our housing revenue account will not generate enough income to actually sustain itself, let alone to be available to invest in new property. So if we are being constrained every which way, and the government needs us to build more houses, it will ultimately have to yield to pressure to letting us make funds available through new means.
Well, see if you can have a word with the Prime Minister and tell him to get that changed then. Anyway,
if only I had that level of influence.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm sure you can do something, Jeff. But anyway, let's move on to some other stories now. And the former Dragon's Den star and Cameron advisor has been charged with child sexual assault. Doug Richards, 57, is charged on four counts relating to offences allegedly committed in January with a 13-year-old. He denies the allegations. This is the latest, but we've also had, this is from last year, former Downing Street aide Patrick Rock charged with possessing child pornography, which that child is going through, charge is going through at the moment. Martin Summers, this is a bit, it's that old phrase, isn't it? If you do it once, it could be an accident, but if it's twice, it's carelessness. This is two advisors to the Prime Minister who've been charged with fairly serious child sexual assault offences. And then, of course, we also had Andy Coulson, who was charged with perjury, who was his personal advisor. It does seem that, you know, there's something not quite right in Downing Street.
Well, I mean, it's very hard to comment on individual cases, as we said earlier. I don't know whether this guy did this or not, and there's no point me presuming that I do. I think there is clearly an issue with people in positions of authority feeling that they can get away with abusing children. And as I've said before on this programme, the real key to all of this is the Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland, where the allegation is that the intelligence services use Kinkora as a means of blackmailing various political figures and paramilitary figures. And I think that underlying all of this is that is my main concern, is that the intelligence services have been using paedophilia as a tool of control, and I think that's the most serious aspect of this from my point of view.
There's another side to this, Jeff, as well, and that is that it was announced yesterday the Independent Police Complaints Commission is to oversee a further 12 cases of alleged historical corruption within the Metropolitan Police. So you've got this problem with child sexual abuse going on, which is the Goddard Inquiry is now looking into that. Apparently it's going to report in 2020, which quite a lot of people are not happy about, it taking so long. But you've got that going on. And then you've also got the people that many of these abused kids would have gone to, the police also being investigated for corruption. That's 30 different allegations against the Metropolitan Police here, and I'll just read out a couple of them. Allegations, the new ones, the ones announced this week, allegations about attempts by Special Branch in the 1970s to interfere in an investigation that would have revealed an MP to be involved in child sex offences. Another one, an allegation that an MP was arrested and then released without charge on the instruction of senior officers following an investigation into a South London paedophile ring in the 1980s. Also alleges officers were threatened with breaking the Official Secrets Act if they spoke of the events. Also an allegation that investigation into child sex offences committed by an MP was taken over by officers from Special Branch and then not progressed. And finally, an allegation that an officer serving with the Metropolitan Police was involved in a paedophile ring in North London that evidence was covered up by Special Branch. I suppose the big thing with this latest tranche is there's quite a lot of people pointing their fingers at Special Branch, saying that these guys were, as police officers were trying to do their job, Special Branch would tap them on the shoulder and say, no, stop the investigation.
The thing I find frightening in all this, and I suppose, if you like, the Savile inquiry and issues is perhaps easier to talk about because that's something that is sadly proven. And what it shows is a culture that was largely condoning of things at the time because of the fame of individuals who were involved. And that is something that I think all decent people find shocking and deplorable. What is of concern is then finding that cover-ups have been happening in police, and indeed I think it was in Rotherham as well, there were cover-ups of things that had been happening. And I certainly would not want to make any political judgments, not least because you can point a finger at a politician from one party and someone can point a finger back at a politician of my party. And I think this is something that is so deplorable that we should all be unified in demanding that proper action is taken, and taken quickly. You mentioned the public inquiry. I'm very involved with a local charity called the Southmead Project, which is an organisation supporting the victims of sexual abuse. And what that charity has proven is that significant amounts of addiction to drugs and alcohol arises from people who've been abused as children, who are actually running away from and trying to blot out the problem. And local authorities and the health service spend a great deal of effort trying to deal with the addiction and aren't actually trying to deal with the underlying problem, because they're not asking the right questions, they're not identifying the history of abuse and providing the counselling. So I believe this is an issue that is going to have a far greater impact on our city and on our communities around the country, because there are very many people who are affected. And the charity's made the point that with so many news stories appearing, every time it appears on a news channel, victims are reminded of the traumas that they went through, and therefore their need for counselling support grows massively every time another story arises.
I mean, the big problem, so far as I can see, one of the biggest problems is that people haven't been believed. They've been to the police and they've got nowhere. Even friends and family are telling them, you know, shut up, this is, you're fantasising about this. And the one positive thing we can say about all of this nasty Jimmy Savile stuff is that suddenly people are actually, or slowly, people are actually being believed.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sad thing that people are almost afraid that because the individual that they would accuse was famous or whatever, they are thinking that their voice wouldn't count. And sadly, the establishment effectively helped to create that view, and we've got to do everything we can now to remedy that situation and ensure that justice is done.
Martin, we had the Chief Crown Prosecutor for the South West on the show last week talking about this, and we put it to him, didn't we? I mean, he was saying, well, actually, we've shown now we can prosecute powerful people, and it's something that we've had to learn to do. And we're prosecuting MPs, and we've been doing this, and we've begun to do it. But there is still a problem, isn't there, with the police being involved in prosecutions of themselves?
Well, not necessarily. You know, the police are supposedly independent. So, for example, in relation to Kincorra, the police service of Northern Ireland should investigate what happened at Kincorra. It was going to be excluded from the Goddard investigation on the grounds that it wasn't part of British jurisdiction, which I think is rather amusing from the Republican point of view.
So basically what you're saying is...
They've now agreed that they are going to include it, and it's across the spectrum in Northern Ireland that people... Because it was mainly loyalist paramilitaries who were tracked to go in there having sex with boys underage and being photographed
and blackmailed by
MI5.
The way it may work is that one police force investigates another. Like, for example, I seem to remember that Devon and Cornwall were investigating the Met.
The various allegations have emerged against the Met, and the way you deal with that is you bring the Northumbria police in or the Northern Ireland police in to look into it.
Well, you might not want to.
That's the way you do
it. You might not want to bring the Lancashire police in, and this is why, because I interviewed earlier on this week a woman called Cheryl Corliss, and she's a victim of the care system in Blackburn, and really just let her speak for herself, I suppose. She's also now part of something called the People's Tribunal, which is peripheral to the Goddard Inquiry, and they're completely separate, but they are being run by independent survivors of sex abuse and independent lawyers and barristers. So let's hear what Cheryl Corliss has to say, her heart-rending story.
It was horrific. One of the nights, they got me so drunk, I could hardly stand up. And I came home, and some of the local lads were out, and I got gang raped in the garden of our home. And I was under the office window, and the staff shut the office window. They shut the window. And then the next day, they told everybody I was a slag, and they pinned up my ripped knickers and put them on the notice board to tell everybody what dirty slag I was. And I went to the police, that's in my paperwork, I went to the police, and it says states in my paperwork in black and white. The police rang the home and said, Cheryl's coming here telling stories about you, you need to watch what she's saying. So it's like everybody knew, and it was just accepted. We were care kids, we weren't important enough for anybody to care or stop it. We were made to feel like we were below society's normal. I ended up getting into a very violent relationship where my partner was physically and sexually and emotionally abusing me for 6 years. At the end of that relationship, I ended up going into labour, and he started punching me while I was in labour. So I ran to the phone box to ring myself an ambulance, and I ended up giving birth in the telephone box. And that's how I ended the relationship. That's where I got the strength. But obviously, everything came back then. I think it was post-traumatic stress. And I was about 25 then. So everything that had happened over the past God knows how many years all come back, and I had a breakdown. But then social services took my children. Before they took my children, I actually went to the police and I said, I think I was abused when I was in care. And then they took my children and they said that I was delusional and I was making stories up about men in suits. Why would they want to rape kids from care? I was delusional, so I must have been delusional about the partner that was beating me up. So they gave him my children.
Pretty horrific story there, and you can hear the full interview next Tuesday at noon here on BCFM. But Martin, I suppose the crux of all this is the police are less likely, or at least were less likely, to investigate claims like this when they knew that Special Branch might be tapping on their shoulder and say, forget about it. Who are Special Branch?
Well, they were set up originally in the 1880s to deal with the Republican terrorism of its day. And then, of course, they became the political wing of policing. There's a real question mark over the intelligence services and Special Branch. There always has been. are they sufficiently under democratic control?
Well, they're not at the moment. There is
well,
no.
There's
there
a lot of people who don't think.
Well,
they
there
are.
Is no Intelligence and Security Committee. I think because of the questions over the Labour leadership, it hasn't actually even been formed since May. So, anyway, Jeff, what are your thoughts about that little example we had there of institutional abuse, where the police are actually collaborating with staff in a children's care home to cover it up?
What can I say? It's not acceptable, and there should be checks and balances that prevent that happening. But we have to recognise that it's back to the comment I made about culture. There are still certain areas where culture is potentially unacceptable. It's there in the sort of sexual innuendo that some people will shout out or express in different places, and it's clearly there in terms of what people will accept in ways of abuse. I believe that the coverage in the media over the last 3 or 4 years has significantly changed that attitude. I would hope that that would be inconceivable today.
Well, let's hope so. And also, I think we've got to definitely be asking questions about the security service MI5 and their links with Special Branch, because it does look as if they may have been actually instigating the closing down
This is what worries me most of all. I don't think in that particular case where we're talking about that. That is just the lower level institutional abuse.
Okay, but it's the culture that's created where that kind of thing can go on. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the Director General of MI5, Andrew Parker, otherwise known as Nosy Parker, and he appeared on a live interview yesterday on BBC Radio 4. One of the things he was talking about was the shape of the present terrorist threat here in Britain as he sees it.
The shape of the threat we face today has changed in some ways, changed because, of course, it's driven from conflict zones and the way people react to that. But because of the internet and the way terrorists use social media, including from Syria, and the way we all live our lives using the smartphones in our pockets, the terrorists do the same, and they're using secure apps and internet communication to try to broadcast their message and to incite and direct terrorism amongst people who live here who are prepared to listen to their message.
Well, there's evidence to show that people who've been recruited to fight in Syria have been recruited by NATO's intelligence services, specifically, for example, MIT, the Turkish intelligence services, who work very closely with our own intelligence services. And many people in Syria believe that most of the terrorists working inside Syria are actually collaborating with the NATO intelligence services.
But what about this picture of the terrorists with the smartphone and...
Well, what the Iraqi resistance realised pretty quickly after the invasion of 2003 is not to touch anything electronic at all, and to operate entirely without electronic devices, because that's the way to get caught and get killed.
I mean, we had an interview, didn't we, with some Bristol crims on here a few years ago, where they said, "Well, we just buy a phone, use it for a few hours, and then throw it in the river."
That's right. That's what drug dealers do, and that's what terrorists do as well.
Jeff, final word on Andrew Parker and this idea of the threat at the moment.
In this day and age, the threat is there permanently. And in a way, the issues we're talking about, we've got to deal with that threat, but we've got to deal with it in an accountable and transparent way. And that is the ongoing challenge.
Okay, time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, that's the Conservative Deputy Mayor and Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, Jeff Gollop. After the Murdoch News, women in Iran.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol.